Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is engineer Kevin Killen. First of all, I don't know if you've read, but Twitter was considering culling its inactive accounts. So in other words, if you had a Twitter account that you didn't log into for 6 months or longer, they were going to remove you, remove your account. And the reason why everybody was thrilled about this, or other users were thrilled about this, is there is lots of really good handles, Twitter handles, that were suddenly going to become available. Well, there was an uproar that kind of stopped the whole thing. And believe it or not, it was because of deceased people and their accounts. If you were dead, there's no way that you could actually log on to your account. But everybody kind of feels that that's a digital legacy that should live on. So as a result, Twitter is now re-examining its policy of culling its inactive files. And it will probably be something just like Facebook and Instagram has. In that case, you can memorialize your account. So all the posts stay alive, but nobody can log in anymore. Family can at first, but then after that you can't. But this is going to become a bigger and bigger problem as we move on, where it's not only deceased people, but it's going to be people that have inactive accounts. And inactive generally means that you didn't log in. It doesn't necessarily mean you didn't post at all. It's that you didn't log in a certain amount of time. But I think we're going to begin to see this happen more and more, where there's going to be policies that say you have to log in once a quarter, once a year, whatever the case may be, or else you risk losing your account altogether. So just be aware that this may come down, and it may come down soon, first for Twitter, but then for everything else. So if you have a particular handle that you really like, make sure you protect it by at least logging in. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my online courses on mixing, production, branding, and music business success at bobbyosinskicourses.com. Also, get an expert analysis and objective opinion of your songs and mixes as a member of my Hitmakers Club. Go to hitmakersclub.com to learn more. Now let's talk about plugins. There's an evolution that's going on, and I'm not so sure that everybody sees this happening. Let me just give you some history of how this worked. In the beginning of digital audio workstations, there were some rudimentary plugins that, for the most part, any engineer, any mixer that had analog experience, they pretty much thought they sounded pretty bad. And then the software developers thought, well, you know what? We should try to make our plugins sound like the analog devices that everybody is used to. So now we had these gear emulations. And again, in the beginning, they weren't that good, but over time, they got better and better. And it got to the point where most experienced mixers would say, you know what? It's 90% of the way there. It's 95% of the way there. I can deal with it. But now things are actually going into a different realm. Now there's a whole new generation of mixers that really haven't had a lot of experience on analog gear to begin with. So as far as emulations are concerned, they don't really care. What they really care about is getting plugins that really help them and help them quickly. Because in today's world, we don't spend as much time recording or mixing or much of that at all. Things happen fairly quickly. So we want to get to the point quickly with plugins especially, and that's why presets are becoming more and more important. Even experienced mixers like presets. Why? Well, it gets them to the point very, very fast where they can say, you know, sounds pretty good. Not going to play too much longer on this. And then we have a whole new suite of machine learning influenced processors that are doing much of the job of a mixer already. Now, you can say that's good, you can say it's bad, whatever the case, this is happening, it's coming, it's becoming more and more viable, and it's getting better at what it does. It's not going to displace anybody, especially great mixers, they still will not be displaced. But for somebody who's just starting, this is a really good place for them to get their feet wet. Now, what I see happening is that the classic engineers have been away from it for long enough, they're sort of forgetting what it was like, and they now see the advantages of being in the box. So now those mixers in particular who are pretty persnickety about the way everything sounded are less so these days. And then you have the new generation of mixers that really don't care one way or the other. And what I see happening is we're going to see fewer and fewer emulations in the future. We're going to see some differentiations go away. So for instance, you have the five different types of reverbs and you have the four different types of compressors. At some point in time, it doesn't matter. So a VCA versus a Varimu compressor doesn't matter so much. Then does it sound good? Does it work well? So I think we're now on the cusp of that happening, where developers have pulled out just about as much as they can from analog gear, from analog emulations, and now we're moving into a new realm of let's just make it work, and let's make it work better than it ever could before, and not worry about making it sound like something. Now, here's something scary that I predict might happen. Remember back in the past where you had studios and you had radio and television stations that were throwing out their analog gear? And you hear all the stories about finding Fairchilds in the dumpster. That may happen again, as now we're so ingrained in the digital domain that analog gear, analog outboard gear, doesn't mean that much to us. And we may see that happen one more time. You know what? This time, nobody might care. So start looking your dumpsters. It might not happen tomorrow. It might not happen next year. But you know what? It is going to happen sooner or later. My guest today is Kevin Killen, who's a multi-Grammy Award-winning engineer who's worked with such luminaries as David Bowie, U2, Peter Gabriel, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble, Sugarland, Shakira, and so many more. Besides working on what many consider seminal albums like Peter Gabriel's So and U2's Unforgettable Fire, Kevin has also worked on Broadway cast albums and movie soundtracks as well. He's also been a longtime proponent of in-the-box mixing and an all-digital workflow, taking up the cause way before it became popular. During the interview, we spoke about working with Peter Gabriel, getting arrangement tips from Burt Bacharach, working on David Bowie's last album, his unique mixing template, and much, much more. I spoke with Kevin via phone from his home in New York. I want to go back to the beginning because I don't know that I ever got your full story. I mean, we've talked several times, but I never heard how you started in the business. So what is your backstory?
The backstory is I was in college in Dublin at Trinity College doing a natural science undergraduate degree. And I was also playing music with friends and I had a drum set. I was taking lessons, and I just was playing music for fun. I grew up in a family of eight, and all my brothers, and sisters loved music, and I was sixth in line of succession. And so we had a lot of music in our house. And I just was looking for something that really kind of made me passionate. And as much as I like science, I didn't see myself pursuing a career in that. So I was coming towards the end of my second year and I needed to find like a summer job. And I think I had seen a documentary about XTC. It was the making of one of the records. I believe it was with Hugh Padgham and Steve Lillywhite. And I thought, oh, that's a really interesting thing. Well, people make records. Oh, I wonder if that's something I'd be interested in, because it kind of brought together all my interests, music, engineering, architecture, which I was interested in as a teenager, and so I just literally pulled out the phone book, like the yellow pages in Dublin, and looked up recording studios, and there were like eight studios in the city at the time, so I went around to each of them just looking for an internship, and one of the studios hired me, and I never went back to college. I just walked in that first day in late April, and I thought to myself, yeah, this is what I want to do. And everybody thought I was completely nuts. So I kind of took a sabbatical for a year, but then I really, within that first year, I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I absolutely adored it. So yeah, that was my basic backstory. I spent a year and a half, almost 2 years in that studio. And then I got hired over at Windmill Lane which was the premier recording studio at the time where U2 did all their work. And I worked there for almost 3 years. And then I kind of pretty much, you know, had risen to kind of the ceiling where as far as I could go. And my bosses were like, well, it's kind of really time, you know, for you to go freelance. And then the question was like, where would I want to freelance? So it was either stay in Dublin, go to London, or, you know, try somewhere else. And Dublin, like I said, is a pretty small music biz community. And I thought, well, no one's going to hire me as an independent engineer when they can hire the house engineer. And in London at the time, you know, there was a real palpable sense of distrust between the English and the Irish, given what was going on politically with the IRA, you know, having a bombing campaign on the British mainland. So that didn't seem like a good move. And I thought, well, you know, historically, the U.S. was being very friendly towards Irish people, or at least it was at that time. So I thought maybe I'd come here. And I had a couple of contacts here. I had just finished a record with Pianino and Daniel Anwar, and to their connections, and also to Jimmy Iovine and Shelly Yakis, they put me in touch with the Hit Factory here in New York. And I knew one other person, Randy Israeli, who owned a remote recording company called FNL.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And he had come to Ireland. Yeah, he came to Ireland to record. We used his system to record The Unforgettable Fire. And so I knew, I got to know Randy over those couple of months. So I knew I had a place to stay. And so I ended up in New York in late 84. And pretty much I stayed here for, you know, I think about, it was November. I stayed until beginning of June, I believe it was, or end of May. And right around that time, Dan Lanvin had called me because he was working on a record with Peter Gabriel and asked me to come over to help him finish it. And he, you know, at the time, I got on a call with him and with Dan and Peter and with their manager, or Peter's manager, Gail Colton. And we thought I'd be over there for maybe about 6 weeks. And I ended up being there for 10 months. And when that record was over, I came back and there was plenty of work and there were things, you know, plenty of offers of jobs and stuff like that. So I ended up basing myself out of New York. And I've been here ever since.
Well, that record with Peter was huge. That couldn't hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it didn't hurt. Peter was very prescient. He when we were getting towards the end of the record, he pulled me aside and said, like, well, what are you going to do, you know, when the record's over? And I was like, well, I'm going back to New York. I have this one offer of this job with Howard Jones, was making a record with Arif Martin. You know, ironically enough, they were actually going to start the record in Dublin at Windmill Lane. So I think I came back to New York for a couple of weeks and then went back to Dublin and started that record with Arif and Howard. But Peter had said to me, you're going to need a manager. He said, I think this record's going to do quite well, and I think you're going to get offers of work, and you need somebody to help you sort through the appropriate course of action and have somebody, you know, represent you and, you know, do contracts and discuss terms and all that kind of stuff. So two of my friends in New York, Ellen Darst and Karen Kaplan, they belong to U2's principal management company here in New York. And they, around that time, they were starting their own little management company called Mambo Management. And when I came back, they asked me, would I be their first client? I think it was T-Bone Burnett and myself were the first two clients that they represented. So, yeah, so they were great and helped me kind of navigate that transition from being, you know, a freelancer into being a freelancer in demand. And it was really helpful, extremely helpful, because they also had worked both at Warner Brothers and at Elektra, and they knew a lot of people within the label system. So it was really great. It was a good transition.
Now, I'm glad to hear you say that, because many engineers that I speak with, when we speak about management, it's usually a pretty negative outlook that they have, because management hasn't helped them a whole lot, or they do it first and then they kind of lose interest. So you're lucky that you've got somebody right away that could be very helpful to you.
Yeah, plus I had known Ellen. Ellen was coming over to Dublin to monitor, you know, U2 albums, you know, while they were in progress. So I'd met her, you know, a number of times in Dublin, and I knew that she was a really beautiful human being, and she's very articulate and smart. And I just thought, oh, she's a great person. And when I moved to New York, I had spoke to Karen on the phone a number of times. So when I went into the office, I met Karen, and you know, we immediately hit it off because of the same age and kind of similar sense of humor. And So, you know, when I was coming back from the Gabriel Records, and, you know, I mentioned to them that Peter said I should get a manager. They were like, well, you know, funny enough, we're starting a management company. And I thought, well, these are two women I absolutely adore, and I think they're super smart. And, yeah, so it was a really great experience. Because one of the hardest things to do as an engineer, or even, not even, I mean, as a self-employed person, it's very hard to negotiate for yourself.
Yeah.
To have that kind of dispassionate view and be able to negotiate in good faith and know what to ask for and, you know, when to push and when not to push. And it's always nice to have somebody in your corner doing that for you. It was great.
You know, the other thing too is when you're working crazy long hours, you kind of get into the mindset of you're only focused on what you're working on, and it's really difficult to then think of business at the same time.
Yeah, and it's also, that's never the conversation you want to have with the artist, because the artist has a manager. It, generally speaking, the label represents themselves. So you really want to have somebody who can have those, you know, dispassionate conversations, yeah, and you don't get any, don't create any animus or anything like that. It's when you walk into the room and you're trying to be creative, nobody's thinking, oh my God, you know, he's so difficult, or she's so difficult, or they're so difficult, when you're just trying to negotiate what you think is a fair and appropriate fee for your time. Because really, at the end of the day, I don't think anybody, even back in the 80s, nobody got rich being paid as an engineer or a mixer, you know. Maybe not from being an engineer. Maybe the mixing, the whole kind of move to mixing, you know, certainly some people got, you know, did really well with that. But I mean, in terms of your engineering record, you got a decent fee. And maybe if you're on the production, you got a chance to participate in the royalties, if there were royalties. But, you know, you were definitely getting paid for your time. And those records took 3, 4, 5 months to make, you know, back in the 80s and the early 90s. You know, you invested a lot of time. Yeah, throughout the process. So
sure.
it was definitely good to have people who could say, oh no, this is appropriate, this is fair, and generally people thought that way, so it was great.
You know, it's interesting because you just mentioned about how long records would take, and it seems like they're a lot faster these days for whatever reason, but I was looking at your discography and I see that you've done something with Yo-Yo Ma and with Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach, which for some reason, I think those didn't take as long as, you know, something like Peter Gabriel. So would your approach be different?
I think it's, you know, each record is unique in its own regard, because depending on what the, you know, the cast of characters assembled, you modify your approach based on what the best way to capture this particular project is. Like with Peter, certainly there was a tracking phase, but then there was a lot of layering going on as Peter worked on lyrics. And so a lot of the music was completed before lyrics were completed. And then once he had finalized lyrics, you go back and you refine some of the music, and sometimes you change the track completely based on what the lyric was doing. But then with something like Silk Road and Yo-Yo Ma, that's an ensemble piece. They pretty much, everything was tracked. A lot of it was tracked simultaneously. That's normally how they play. So you get a chunk of the record in a, you know, week or 10 days of tracking, but then you go back in and you refine stuff and maybe there's some overdubs. But yeah, the actual recording portion of it is quite quick. And then with Elvis and Burt, well, I've done 7 or 8 albums with Elvis over the years, and he always likes to work quite fast. So you know, typically, you would track a whole record in a couple of weeks, and then there'd be overdubs and, you know, some sweetening and then mixing. So maybe 6 or 8 weeks with him. With the collaborative record that he did with Burt Bacharach, you know, Burt came in and everything was already, we actually had recorded God Give Me Strength first as a one-off song. That was the very first song they wrote together. And then like, they enjoyed that experience so much that about a year and a half later, we went back into the studio to record the rest of the songs. So in that intervening period, they worked on all the writing and Burt arranged everything. And on day one of tracking, I mean, there was a lead sheet and you could see everything, you know, out on the score. And we tracked with, you know, drums, bass, 2 guitars, 2 pianos, Elvis singing live. So we, you know, a lot of, I think of 12 or 13 songs on that record, 6 or 7 of the vocals were caught live during the tracking. So we did probably 2 weeks of tracking and then 2 weeks of overdubs with backgrounds and horns and strings and percussion. and then about, 12 days for mixing. And we even mixed that record by hand, like without using automation.
Uh-huh.
So we just felt more organic to do it that way. And it was fun. And it, actually, during that record, it was the first time where Bert, when we got into mixing the first song, he goes, okay, let's start with the vocal. So we pushed up the vocal first. He says, okay, bring up the piano. And we kind of worked the mix from the top down, like vocal, piano, all the counterpoint instruments, all the harmony. And then we worked in percussion and drums last. And it was interesting, like mixes went quite fast because, I mean, we all knew the material. But he spent the whole time, probably from tracking, from the initial tracking right through the mixing, actually removing parts from the arrangement. And we had done a couple of mixes, and I said to him, okay, so you come in the beginning, everything's arranged, but then you spend the majority of time removing elements as opposed to most of the producers I've worked with, they keep adding. And he goes, yeah, I kind of write that way deliberately. I tend to overwrite it, maybe over embellish a little bit, but then when it gets the mix, I really just want to hear like the perfect distillation of the arrangement so that when the listener gets to the end of the song, they really yearn to go and hear it again. He said, that's what I'm trying to go for. And I thought that was such an interesting, approach. And when you listen to his records, they are, they can be quite spare at times. And then there's like a little flourish and a little beautiful moment or motif. And maybe it only happens once, and then you go back and you listen to it again because you really want to hear that little exceptional moment. And it was such a clever way of working.
Yeah.
So it kind of informed the way I worked ever since. That was back in 96, 97, I believe. Yeah. Fascinating.
So were the arrangements really thick then, and then you thinned them out?
They weren't super thick, but yet again, they probably had more moments in them and he just decided, okay, we don't need to have the second piano playing in that verse, and we don't need to have a horn line do this, and we don't need to have all the background parts singing all the choruses. So he really kind of kept distilling it down. He might have them perform in each section that he had originally written for, but then he would kind of pare down the arrangements. So I wouldn't say they were super thick in the beginning, but they were certainly beautiful arrangements. Since we recorded with a large section during the tracking, you could really hear how the arrangement sounded, but the sonic relationship of everything. But then he was going to add percussion, orchestral percussion, and strings, and horns, and background vocal parts. So yeah, he wanted to pare things down as well. It's just a fascinating way of working.
I know you worked on David Bowie's last record, Black Star. Did everyone know he was ill when you were working?
On day one of the record, that's when everybody found out. Yeah. Up to that point, nobody knew. The record was originally slated to begin 3 or 4 months beforehand, and we all got informed that there was a delay. And then the first day in the studio, David came in and announced the reason for the delay was that he'd been ill, but that he was determined. He said, I'm feeling good, and I really want to make this record, and I'd like everybody to, just respect my privacy. So we all had to sign an NDA and stuff like that. So we were very, very cognizant of, his personal space. But he was fantastic every day in the studio. He came in, and he was very energetic and very focused, and we got through a lot of material pretty quickly, so it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm curious how quickly he worked. In speaking with Ken Scott, he would tell me stories about the albums he worked on where it'd be first, second, third take, and that was it. And the musicians would actually be frustrated saying, wait, I can play it better. And you go, no, I'm happy with that. Was it somewhat the same?
Well, he had chosen Donny McCaslin's band. So it's Donny, Mark Giuliani, Jason Linder, and Tim LaFave playing bass. And they're a really solid quartet. I mean, they can just play anything. So I think they had heard demos of the material. So we would typically come in, they would listen to the demo. They knew what they were going to play. The quartet would go out and play it. David would listen. And then he would go out and join them in the live room, and he would sing with them, and we do maybe 2 or 3 takes. And generally speaking, yes, it was, probably one of those takes that was the final one. And we would often come back and maybe try a different version of the song on a different day, maybe a slightly different arrangement, or maybe he'd come up with a different idea. We would do the exact same thing. But in general, yeah, they were, first, second, third takes. And like I said, the band was so tight that there weren't that many mistakes. you know, these are really good players. But it had a real rawness to it and a freshness to it because, yet again, it's that thing in the studio where if you play something 20 times, it's hard to generate the same, there's more detail, but that freshness is perhaps just actually just kind of dulled a little bit.
Ken also told me a story about working with Richard Perry, speaking of what you're just talking about, where Richard felt that he couldn't get a good take out of the band until they played it at least 30 times. So they would play it and play it and then get tired. And he felt that as soon as they came out the other end, when they kind of got frustrated, they get some energy, and that's when he get the best take, which that must be difficult for everybody, you know, going through that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've witnessed that too many times, and sometimes I've been the one pushing it too, where you're digging for something, you're not quite sure what it is you're digging for, you just keep feeling like it's not quite there yet, and everybody's wondering, and then people start to second guess what they're playing. But eventually you arrive at a place where it can be, you know, you get the take that you feel has all the essence of the spirit and the detail that you want, and you hope that everybody enjoys the journey. And yeah, I mean, look, it's only human nature to be frustrated because it's not nice to be under the microscope, you know, continuously. I mean, musicians like to be able to play things, and they like to be able to do things in a you know, efficient manner and with some spirit and emotion. And it's hard to keep that level of all those three attributes up when you played it for the 40th or 50th time. So, it's an interesting, an interesting experience.
Yeah. What do you prefer, recording or mixing?
You know, I like both for different reasons. I like the creativity associated with recording. You know, when you don't really know exactly what it is you're going for, and you have a group of creative people in the room, and you just kind of collaborate together to come up with something cool, either in terms of the arrangement, in terms of the sound, and then you execute that. Then obviously with mixing, it's more of a solitary endeavor, so you kind of get into your own head and just try different things, especially in today's environment where everything is kind of in the DAW environment. They're both different. They're both very different headspaces. I think that mixing is a real focused kind of thing, and it's not to say that recording is not, it's just a focus in a different way. You're looking at the bigger picture, whereas mixing, you tend to get drawn down into the details more and more.
When you're mixing these days, are you doing it faster than when you used to do it on a console, or does it take longer for you?
It depends on the project. I would say if it's something that I've recorded and been involved in from the beginning, it's probably a little faster. If it's something that I've had no relationship up to that point, then I have to learn the song a little bit. Maybe it takes a little bit longer. And it's all driven by people's budgets these days. I mean, as it always was, but it's certainly more of a given now. People want everything. You know, people don't have budgets, ostensibly, at this point. And so they want things to sound good quickly. And so I've just developed a different approach to mixing in the box from what I did on the console, just to kind of be more efficient and get to the broader strokes more quickly. And then if the artist wants to get into refined detail, then we can do that and it's still efficient. So yeah, they're very different headspace. I mean, I find them different for myself. Anyway, I find I get thrown if I'm working on a mix and then someone says, oh, let's go do some recording. I'm like, wait, that's a very different thing, you know, and it does happen. But and sometimes it's great, you know, you get a different perspective. But I find for myself, I go into a different zone when I'm mixing versus when I'm recording.
You don't use a lot of processing, do you?
It depends. I mean, generally speaking, I don't use a lot of processing. Well, certainly with things that I've recorded, I try to capture things that actually have the processing already embedded in it, and that's just coming from my training as an engineer who worked on tape, you know, in the pre-automation days. So, you know, in the first studio I worked at Lombard Sound, there was no automation on the console, so everything was done manually. So if we wanted a particular effect that we were monitoring that we liked, you know, it probably behooved us to print it onto the multi-track. And then at Wimble Lane, we had the first console we had was an MCI, and that was that, you know, with the automation, you ping pong the automation data between track 22 and track 24. You could probably get about 8 passes, and then it was kind of really good for mutes and maybe for a little bit of VCA volume automation. But after that, you know, it started to kind of lag behind the music with a delay. And then when we got an SSL at Wimble Lane, we, at the time, it must have been a cost concern. They didn't have Total Recall, you know, purchased as an option for the console. So, you know, you could do recalls, but it was just faders and pan pots really at that point. So, so I got used to mixing by hand, and I kind of enjoyed that experience because it was very much like a performance. And so when I work that way, it's certainly an easier way to work. But now when everything's in the box, you know, I try to take that attitude and bring it into the box and try and get mixes up fairly quickly. And, you know, I'll use processing if I think the recording warrants it. But if it doesn't, then it's not the first thing I do. It's like stick on a bunch of, you know, plugins. And, you know, we all have a different way of approaching these kind of things. I know a lot of engineers out there whose work I admire. You know, when I see them give their breakdown of what they do, I go, wow, that's a lot of stuff, but it always sounds great. So, you know, who's to say what's the best approach? It's just whatever makes, whatever works and whatever moves the artist at the end of the day is the right approach.
Speaking of workflow, I watched a video that you were in. Oh, it was for MixCon, I think.
Oh, yeah, the MixCon, yeah.
Which was very good, and you were excellent in your presentation. But I noticed that you weren't using the master fader in Pro Tools. Instead, you were using a couple of auxes as your master. What's the reason for that?
So what I was doing, what my kind of mixing template is, I have, you know, 3 or 4 different pathways that I kind of push my audio down. I put like a drum and percussion sub, and then there's like a music sub. All the harmonic content goes down that one subgroup, and it's through an auxiliary. And then I have like a vocal sub. And then those three are all outputted to one final auxiliary. And I usually put like some final processing on that. And then the output of that goes to a print track. And I print right back into the multi-track. But actually pre all those auxes is a little master fader, and I use that as a pre-post send into the auxiliaries, just to, you know, as a way of gain staging it. When I first started mixing in the box, and maybe it was like 2003, 2004, the whole tactile nature of working on a control surface or trying to work with a mouse, I found that really frustrating because you could really only do one thing. You could only instantiate an EQ or, you know, turn an EQ, process an EQ on one track at one moment in time. Whereas on a regular analog console, you can have both hands going. So I try to... the plugins that I was using, I tried to use kind of more mastering style plugins because I really wanted to not instantiate plugins on every track. I was like, is there a way of mixing the box that you can utilize minimum plugin set but still get maximum value? And I had just done a record with Peter Gabriel back at Real World where we had gone back and we had done a surround mix of So, and he wanted like a reverential version of it that just, you know, where if you flip between the stereo and the surround, it just sounded like a fold out of the original mix. And we had done that on a Sony Oxford console, and the original console we used was an SSL 4000E, and you know, I really liked the way the console sounded. It was, you know, the A to D sounded great, and I also thought the compressors and the dynamic section sounded really great and very analog and musical. So then Sony Oxford came out with a suite of plugins for Pro Tools, and I think they just had the EQ and they had the full dynamic section. And Peter had asked me to do a mix for Real World Records, and there was this Irish artist named Irla Leonard, who was originally one of the members of Afro Celts. But he was singing, he put together a solo record and he was singing it in Gaelic. and Peter asked me if I would mix the record. So but they wanted me to mix in the box. And so I think it was might have been right around the time of, which is post TDM and first iteration of HT. So you could use delay compensation.
Oh, yeah.
So I used that suite of plugins, and this record was a combination of acoustic instruments, so acoustic guitars, upright basses, some electronic components from synths and samples, and then also like some old frame drums like Barons and stuff like that, and so it had a big wide dynamic range, and it also like sonically had a lot of like super lows, and I wanted to do something that kind of kept that intact. And I found that suite worked really well. So I just created these kind of bus paths, and I drove everything down, and I just put my EQ and my compression across the buses. And when I sent it to Bob Ludwig, because I was in the room I was working in, it was a very shallow room. So at the mix position, it sounded great. But if you put your head back like 5 or 6 inches, all the low-end information just sounded really super huge and super loud and out of balance. And so when I sent it to Bob, he took a listen and he was like, this sounds great. Like, whatever you're doing, don't change a thing. And then we finished the record and sent it over to Peter. And Peter was like, it's the best record we've done today. It's the best sounding record we've had on Real World Records. So I thought, oh, I can mix in the box and I can use this as a template. So I modified it a little bit over time, but it's still essentially the same. I still use the same thing. So in that mix column class, there is a master fader. You know, maybe there was no fade out on that song. I think there's like a full stop or something like that on the song. But there is a master fader in which one could do a fade out or fade in if one needed to. So, yeah. Funny, I haven't changed that. I might have changed the plugins that I've used, but essentially I still pretty much work the same way. I try to tell, you know, young mixers are like, I can get a good mix using these 8 plugins across these 4 auxiliaries. And then if I need to instantiate something on an individual track, I'll do that. But I always start trying to get my balance using this kind of subgrouping and see if I can get it to work that way.
Well, that must make everything go a lot faster then, because you're dealing with balance rather than processing most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, especially with something that I've worked on, I kind of know a good balance that kind of works. With something that I'm learning as I'm mixing, I might try and push and pull it, you know, a bunch of different ways. And it also depends on what what the client is requesting. You know, it has different tastes, and sometimes they'll want a much more processed version of what they've delivered. And I'm happy to go that route too, because that's fun. Like, that's one of the fun aspects of mixing. Oh, I get to really go in and try lots of effects. So that's great. I can have some fun with it. But yeah, your basic setup for the mix. You know, you're working with these defined parameters, and it's worked in the past. I know it will work in most instances. And you know, it's like a console. You know, it's like you have your trusted EQ and your trusted compressors, and you know, then it works. It forces you to work on the balance, and the right balance, and hopefully, we'll make everything, you know, fall into place.
I know you're a big fan of Universal Audio and all their plugins. Are there other ones that you use that you find you're always going back to?
You mean within the UAD suite, or just generally?
Well, let's start there in the UAD suite, and then tell me some of the other ones that you might be going to often.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many great companies out there that make so many great plugins. But I've kind of, over the years, I've tried to distill it down into ones that I know I can use, that I feel like, oh, I can use this to get this result. So in the UAD suite, I certainly like the LA2s, the LA3s, the Pultec emulations, the Neve 1073s. I found it great. And they also have a Helios EQ, which was the original console I worked on, so that's kind of familiar to me. And then I really like their Transient Designer. It's such a great little tool for either expanding reverberation or tightening something up that maybe has too much space around it. And then in terms of effects, I love the 224, there are MX-16. They're great. And the EMT plates, both the 140 and the 250, are all fantastic. So they, you know, I'll use those. And then they also have emulations of Millennia, the NSEQ2, which I love. I have the hardware box of that, and I love that EQ because it has the twin topology, both the solid state and the tube. And you can set up your EQ curve and then flip between the two and see which one, you know, you like best. And the Cambridge EQ is also great. You know, yet again, and the API stuff. I mean, there's just so many choices, and sometimes there are too many choices. And then I'm a big fan of Eventide. I love all their, you know, all the harmonizers and the Omnipressor and Black Hole. I mean, there's just so many great things. They have this thing called Fizion or Fizion, I think they pronounce it.
Oh yeah,
that's also a really great it's a really great little box. And then obviously I still use this the Sonox stuff. They have their EQ and the inflator and the full dynamic section, and I really like their super DS or suppressor, they call it. That's also a very great little tool. And yet again, I mean, I start off with my default. And then depending what the material is, I might switch some things out because maybe something wants a different color. But I kind of have a, you know, Dan Lanois and Brian, you know, when I was working with them back in Dublin back in 1984, they were, you know, really encouraging me to, like, you know, find the things you really like and get to know how to use them really well. And once you know how to use them well, like, they're your trusted items to go to, and they won't let you down. And it was really good advice. So, you know, yet again, those things, you figure out a way to make them, you know, current, and at the same time feel kind of reverential in terms of, you know, the era from which they came from. So it's pretty cool.
What monitors are you using?
Oh, I'm using Proax Studio 100s, and I have a shallow amplifier that I have connected to them, and that's my main set of monitors. And then I have a Grace headphone amp and a pair of Sennheiser, what are they, 580s, I think they are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much that's my mix room, and then pair of Adams NS2As and another set of monitors that I use a lot.
What are the challenges that you're facing these days?
I think managing expectations is probably one of the biggest challenges, because with the fact that everybody can record themselves, you know, the variety of projects that you get offered and the quality of them, you know, varies from project to project. Some are very well recorded and produced, and then sometimes you get projects that are, you know, recorded well in bits and maybe not so well in other areas. That's one. So the variety of stuff, like, people, you know, everybody wants their record to sound the best it possibly can be, and sometimes if they didn't actually capture that on the recording, then it's very hard sometimes to deliver exactly what they're requesting. And so managing that expectation that's a challenge. Also, you know, in a lot of cases, you get sessions where nobody really made a decision along the way. They didn't make a decision about what the sonic kind of footprint of their record was going to be. And they didn't really make a decision in terms of the arrangements, and things are a little loose in terms of the arrangement and in terms of all the choices of performances, and they're looking to the mixer to make those choices for them. And that goes back to what I said, like, that almost becomes like recording if you have to sift through and make those choices for the artist. And that's fine. I'm happy to do it, but at the same time, that's not mixing. That's almost like production in some regard. So, and if you're trying to get a mix done in a reasonable amount of time, let's say, you know, 6 hours, because that's what the budget will allow, then any of those kind of detours distracts from, you know, really what your time should be spent doing. So there are some of the challenges. And, you know, just wish that people, at the end of the day, the way in which the consumer listens to music is, you know, streaming, you know, at a broadcast standard that's pretty low. So it'd be nice if everybody was listening in high fidelity, and you know,
yeah,
so that people could actually really appreciate what it is we do. So And it's, you know, we've kind of dumbed down the deliverable method, and that's a shame.
Last question for you. What's the best piece of advice that someone ever gave you, or maybe you learned along the way?
I think with Brian Eno and Daniel Lenoir, when I was a young engineer, they pulled me aside and they said, you know, there's often a tendency for young engineers to get their engineering chops together and then move on to production or move on to, you know, move on to another aspect of their career. And they said, why don't you, you know, really become a master of, you know, a master recordist, you know, really kind of drill down and as soon as you become like an expert in that, then move on to the next discipline. Like, don't try and do all together simultaneously, because you'll end up doing them all badly. And, you know, if you get a reputation for being a really good recording engineer, then somebody will give you the opportunity to mix the record that you've recorded. And from then, you know, somebody will give you the opportunity to perhaps collaborate and be a co-producer. And that was the advice I took. And I, you know, I'd really tried to become a really good recording engineer first. And, you know, just through experience and collaborations and happenstance, you know, I got offered the opportunity to co-produce, because all the projects I worked on, with all the people that I worked with, both, you know, both producers and engineers and musicians and artists, you know, everybody created a collaborative environment. And, when the time came to move up to the next level, you know, I'd already had a lot of experience that I just didn't realize that I'd had. So, you know, I try to become a good recordist first, and then I try to become a good mixer. And then, you know, when somebody offered me a chance to co-produce, when I thought I was ready, I took that opportunity.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find them on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.